Today is Friday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
This has been going on pretty much all week. The police were called into the area after there was disturbances in this camp at the Port de la Chapelle last weekend.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. We'll have full details coming up. Also ahead, a powerful bomb rips through a marketplace in southwestern Pakistan this morning, killing at least 18 people and wounding 48 others. And the Taliban unleashes an Afghan spring offensive despite a U.S. push for peace. It's all on today's International Edition. A powerful bomb ripped through a marketplace this morning in southwestern Pakistan, killing at least 18 people and wounding 48 others. Police officials said an explosive device planted in a shop caused the blast in a Shiite Muslim-dominated part of Quetta, the capital of Balochistan province. Members of the Shiite minority community were among the victims. There were no immediate claims of responsibility for the violence that occurred, which has experienced such attacks in the past. Sunni extremists have been blamed for previous attacks. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan condemned today's attack. The Taliban announced today its annual spring offensive in Afghanistan amid U.S.-led pushes for a negotiated settlement to the 18-year-old war with the Islamist insurgency. The offensive, dubbed Al-Fath, which means victory in Arabic, commenced throughout the country. The Taliban said it aims to establish an Islamic system in an Afghanistan cleansed from American occupation. Observers, however, say the announcement is largely symbolic because insurgents in recent years have not eased battlefield activities during winters and staged major attacks against Afghan forces as well as their U.S.-led NATO partners. Associated Press reporter Karen Chalmers has more.
The yearly announcement was released in several languages, including English, saying the fighting would continue while foreign forces remain in Afghanistan. The insurgents, who hold sway over half the country, carry out daily attacks targeting Afghan security forces and NATO troops, yet often killing many civilians as well. A recent Taliban attack near the main U.S. airbase in Afghanistan killed three Marines. The Afghan High Peace Council condemned the Taliban announcement, saying it brought into question the insurgents' sincerity in seeking a peaceful end to the war. I'm Karen Chamas.
While Sudan's new military rulers say they plan to restore the country to civilian rule, ideally within 2 years. At a news conference today, General Omar Zayin Abedin also said the military authorities will not extradite ousted President Omar al-Bashir, who was wanted by the ICC to face charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Protesters in Sudan, who have been demonstrating for 4 months against the country's autocratic president, defied a curfew last night that was imposed after the president's ouster by a military coup. Demonstrators say they want civilian leaders instead of military leaders at the country's helm. While Sudan now faces a future without President Bashir, who ruled for 30 years, VOA's Salem Solomon reports that it is far from clear what that will mean for the country.
Protest leaders and analysts predict more change as Sudan adjusts to a new reality without the president who led the country for 3 decades. In a surprise address Thursday that aired on national television, Defense Minister Awad Ibnouf announced that the military had staged a coup, ousting President Omar al-Bashir.
This is just a continuation of the same regime, actually. They're just changing faces, recycling leaders. But it's the same regime trying to come with it in a new different shape. But we will not be fooled with this.
Sarah Abdul-Jalil, a protest organizer and a spokesperson for the Sudanese Professionals Association, said that protesters have no intention of following the curfew or accepting military rule.
So Sudan uprising will continue.
The Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors reported that at least 13 people have been killed Thursday in clashes between protesters and security forces. Videos of ongoing protests in the streets filled social media with reports from Khartoum indicating that hundreds defied the curfew and remained outside army headquarters. In recent days, images of soldiers alongside protesters singing, chanting, and playing music have circulated on social media. Observers are now closely watching the rank-and-file soldiers to see if they will continue to side with protesters or begin cracking down on the gatherings at the urging of the new regime. Jean-Baptiste Galpin is a PhD candidate in sociology in Yale University and a former Sudan researcher at Amnesty International.
And these people went very far as insubordination. They called on their colleagues to join them. So in effect, they committed an act of mutiny. And if the regime stays as it is, they are likely to get punished. So they have a strong interest in, staying on the side of demonstrators and pushing for further change.
Eric Reeves is another Sudan researcher and a senior fellow at Harvard University. He said widespread anger over Sudan's declining economy has accompanied dissatisfaction with single-party rule. Sudan has lost significant oil revenue in recent years, and its currency has deteriorated in value. Last year, inflation reached 70%, and the government slashed subsidies for fuel and bread. Reeves said the change in leadership at the top will not alter the harsh realities on the ground.
This fools nobody, addresses none of the issues, and certainly does nothing to bring about the kind of changes that will rescue the Sudanese economy from its present collapse, and it is collapsing.
Reeves said, unlike countries like Libya or Somalia, Sudan has a long history of political parties and political institutions. He is hopeful that this history will help the country avoid the type of bloodshed seen in other parts of the world that experienced sudden power vacuums.
I think the feeling was that by arresting al-Bashir, that would take the steam out of the uprising. But that's not the case. So we're looking at a period of great uncertainty. I'm very hopeful that the middle ranks of the army will begin to break away from the regime.
Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
Among the top stories in the world, al-Shabaab militants are suspected in the abduction of two Cuban doctors working in a Kenyan town on the border with Somalia. North Korea's Supreme People's Assembly re-elected leader Kim Jong-un as a chairman of the State Affairs Commission. And two U.S. media outlets report President Donald Trump proposed twice that government agencies transport and release detained immigrants in so-called sanctuary cities in retaliation for Democrats' failure to support his plans to build a southern border wall. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2007, astronomers discovered a dwarf planet in the Kuiper Belt that was given the designation of 2007 OR10. The small planet is said to be red in color, 1,250 kilometers wide, has its own moon, and is the fifth largest celestial body to exist in a region of the solar system that is beyond the orbit of Neptune. It's also the largest known body in the solar system without a name. After almost 12 years of being nameless, the planet's discoverers, Meg Schwamm, Mike Brown, and David Rabinowitz, say it's about time it has a name. So they've invited the public to select one of three suggested names that can be submitted to the International Astronomical Union for official recognition. To help pick a name for this dwarf planet, visit www.2007or10.name. Voting ends at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Time on May 10th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, Paris police continue to clear migrant encampments in the north of Paris around Porte de la Chapelle. Last week, police evacuated some 320 who had been living in tents alongside the motorway. This week, in several operations, at least 500 have been moved into state-run facilities where they will be given food and shelter while their requests to stay are processed. The evacuations come as tension rises between the mayor of Paris and the state over who has responsibility for the migrants. Also, the French Interior Ministry has said France will take in 20 of the migrants on board the CI, a migrant aid ship that is anchored outside Maltese waters with about 60 would-be migrants on board. I spoke with reporter Catherine Field for details on these latest developments.
This has been going on pretty much all week. The police were called into the area after there was disturbances in this camp at the Port de la Chapelle last weekend. These disturbances were involved, you know, fights between different groups of migrants. So it really did put pressure on the state authorities to find somewhere else for these migrants to live. It's been a camp of small tents beside the motorway and beside the canal. So on Thursday was the biggest clearance in that area. Some 387 males were moved from that area to reception centres, and 118 families, women and children, were moved from another encampment nearby. They were sent to special centres. Now, that follows last week when some 1,200 migrants were moved also from that area, and really is bringing to a head this dispute between the mayor of Paris and state authorities, both accusing the other of not doing enough to either deter migrants from coming to these encampments or to look after them once they get here.
Also, I understand the mayor has released funds and entrusted the Salvation Army to set up a daycare facility.
Yes, and part of the response to this has been that the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, has asked the Salvation Army to come in and set up a daycare center. Now, this center will include health facilities, hygiene, it will have toilets and showers, will also allow for camp beds to be set up there during the day. And once it's set up sometime next week, then there will be place for some 1,200 migrants to go, at least during the day. Now, of course, you might recall, this does somewhat mirror the settlement that was set up several years ago by the mayor of Paris in that same area, which the mayor actually had to close down because she said it wasn't being used. Again, we're going back to the same issue, if you like, Kim, of looking after the migrants but not really knowing how to in any great way.
Also, in another issue regarding migrants, those that are on the CI vessel, I understand that France is saying they're going to take 20 of those migrants?
They are indeed. This vessel is still moored in the waters outside Malta. France has said that it will take 20 of the 60 migrants on board, has said that it will check their papers, see if they are able to come and live in France, but has said that they can come to France while this process is taking place. They also say that the German government is looking at taking some of those migrants as well. But again, we're back to the situation where you've got these migrant vessels moored outside Maltese waters with these migrants on board, mostly from Eritrea, Sudan, and Afghanistan, just desperate to get to Europe, to get to safety.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Well, a senior UN official is appealing to Russia and Turkey as guarantors of a de-escalation agreement in Syria's Idlib province to prevent fighting from intensifying in the rebel-held enclave. The official briefed journalists in Geneva on a meeting of the International Syria Support Group's Humanitarian Access Task Force. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
More than 3 million civilians live in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib. Most are trapped in this enclave with nowhere to go in the event of a full-fledged war between Russian-backed Syrian forces and rebels. A 2018 de-escalation zone agreement, mediated by Russia, Turkey, and Iran, succeeded in maintaining an uneasy peace in this volatile area, which appears to be breaking down. UN Senior Humanitarian Advisor for Syria, Najat Rushdie, says the United Nations has been receiving troubling reports during the past few weeks of increased military activity and attacks in Idlib. Rushdie says 106,000 people have fled their homes since February, and at least 190 people have been killed as a direct result of increased fighting.
We have a readiness plan for up to 900,000 people who could be affected in northwestern Syria if limited military action takes place, but many more people would be affected. Any large-scale military offensive in the northwest would put thousands of lives at risk and affect an even larger number of people and very likely overwhelm our humanitarian partners.
Rushdie says recent talks by Russia and Turkey regarding the resumption of patrols in the area give her some hope a devastating conflict might be averted. Rushdie says another area of great concern is the humanitarian crisis unfolding in Al-Hol camp in Al-Hasaka governorate in northeast Syria. She says the camp population exceeds 73,000 in a space originally meant for 41,000 people. Most of those arriving in the camp have fled the Islamic State group's last stronghold in Deir ez-Zor governorate. Rushdie says 92% of the camp inhabitants are women, children, and the elderly. She says there are no males over the age of 15. Rushdie says people are extremely vulnerable, and most who arrive in Al-Hol are malnourished and suffering from a wide range of health problems. She says referral hospitals are overwhelmed and cannot accept any more patients. Other pressing needs, she says, include shelter, water and sanitation, and hygiene. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, sitting alongside South Korea's president, U.S. President Donald Trump expressed willingness to hold another summit with North Korea's leader to try to reach a sweeping denuclearization deal. We get details from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
There are various smaller deals that could happen, Trump said to a reporter in the Oval Office when asked if he could accept any agreements shy of denuclearization.
You can work out step-by-step pieces, but at this moment, we're talking about the big deal. The big deal is we have to get rid of the nuclear weapons.
Trump, responding to another reporter, said he has decided not to toughen sanctions on Pyongyang, but wants the existing ones to remain in place. South Korean President Moon Jae-in told Trump that the first summit the U.S. president held in Singapore with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last June led to a significant reduction of tension on the Korean Peninsula and that there is a need for a third summit. A second summit in Hanoi earlier this year ended prematurely with no agreement. Trump declined to say if he had been in communication about that with Kim in recent weeks. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
A top South Korean court has ruled that the country's criminal ban on abortion is unconstitutional. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, the ruling means the 66-year-old law could be nullified by the end of next year.
South Korea is one of very few developed countries with an anti-abortion law. That's in large part because of an influential evangelical Christian community. But polls have shown women, especially young women, support greater abortion rights. Bae is a Seoul resident in her late 30s. She says she thinks it's a positive, as giving birth to a child determines a woman's life, and from now on, a woman can make such an important decision by herself. Choi Ji-un is a South Korean commentator who supports women's rights. She says restricting women's self-determination rights and punishing women, as well as doctors, intimidates them. She says it's a positive change that these acts will be abolished. Under the current law, women who have abortions can be fined or imprisoned for up to a year. Doctors could be jailed for up to 2 years. In reality, the law was rarely enforced. The ruling gives lawmakers until the end of 2020 to change the law. If they can't do it by then, the ban will end.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, a conversation with Michael Mandelbaum about his new book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. He blames Vladimir Putin's Russia, Xi Jinping's China, and the theocratic regime in Iran for ending the 25 years of peace after the fall of the Berlin Wall. That's Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Thank you. Voters in India yesterday began choosing hundreds of lawmakers in the country's general election that will determine the fate of incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The voting over next 6 weeks is seen as a referendum on Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party. Modi supporters say he has improved the nation's standing, but critics say his party's Hindu nationalism has aggravated religious tensions in India. Voting ends on May 19th. Ballot counting is scheduled to begin May 23rd. For more insight into India's elections and what effect they are having on neighboring Pakistan, VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for the South Asia Program at the Washington-based Wilson Center.
Yeah, I think it's true that he has tried to inject a nationalist sentiment into a campaign rhetoric and his rhetoric on the whole in the last few weeks, and I think it comes out of this recent crisis with Pakistan, this recent dogfight, so to speak, when you had each country launching airstrikes on the other's soil. And Modi and his BJP have really been trying to push that point across to voters, essentially saying that, look, we've showed our strength. We responded to this horrific terrorist attack by staging strikes in Pakistan, and it shows that we have resolve, we have strength, we have capacity to fight back against the enemy. And, you know, there's several reasons why Modi has wanted to do that. One is that talking tough about Pakistan always plays well on the campaign trail in India. And the second reason why he did that is that, you know, Modi and his party had come under some significant fire in recent months. It's a part of the BJP has been looking increasingly vulnerable, mainly because of unemployment numbers have been going up very high. And I think that the party wanted to try to find a way to restore some of the strength that it had had in earlier on in its term. So having this situation where you essentially call out Pakistan and talk about how terrible it is and talk about how India is strong, it's going to demonstrate to the world that it's able to fight back. I think that serves a useful political purpose, and it really has helped strengthen the BJP's electoral fortunes.
Has that happened? Do you expect Modi to retain his seat?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, even before this crisis with Pakistan, I thought the BJP and Modi were in good position to come back. But, you know, now what you have is this added benefit of being able to showcase strength and resolve because of the fact that India launched these strikes in Pakistan. I think that the BJP will be reelected. It's, in my view, it will not be elected with the strong mandate that it had when it was elected in 2014. And that's because of all the disappointments, the unemployment issues, the fact that unemployment figures are so high, and really because I think that many people in India felt let down by the BJP and thought that, you know, the BJP, which had been elected on a mandate to push through economic reforms, really did not come through in that regard. So it will lose a significant number of votes. You have a lot of disaffected people, but at the end of the day, the opposition has simply not mounted a strong enough campaign to be able to pose a truly realistic threat to the BJP. So bottom line, we're going to see, in my view, the BJP be reelected. Modi will likely remain prime minister, but it will probably have to govern within a larger coalition than before because it simply will not have as many parliamentary seats as it had during its previous term.
That was Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for the South Asia Program at the Washington-based Wilson Center, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.